pleasure to be back at Santa Barbara, and I'll be reporting about some work, or maybe the word exploration is more appropriate at the point.
Yeah, over on the table on the far side.
Done in collaboration with Hong Liu and Greg Moore, and wrote a paper. And we also owe a lot of thanks to Gary Horowitz for asking very good questions. So this is kind of a caricature of the system we'll study, which is very roughly two cones touching at the tip, cross a line, except that this picture is very inaccurate near the singularity here, and I'll have more to say about this. As motivation, for years I personally used to ignore time as a with its signature, with two arguments. One is that we know that space and time were unified by Einstein, so it's the same thing. And besides, we just rotate to Euclidean signature anyway. And I learned to appreciate that these two arguments are wrong, and we should really learn how to deal with time.
As you look in the mirror.
So there are many interesting questions in time dependent in general, even without gravity. Questions like, what's the vacuum? Even the notion of an eigenstate of a Hamiltonian is not the right question, because if the Hamiltonian is time dependent, you don't diagonalize it, let alone look for the ground state. Question of gravity, what are the observables? Everything we are used to do doesn't work. We have singularities, becomes even more confusing. We learn a lot in the context of string theory what happens when there are time-like singularities. What happens when they're space-like or null singularities, we don't fully understand. These are questions which are important both in the context of black hole, or also more practically or more pragmatically perhaps, with the question of cosmology. This is a singularity that we want to understand, we have to understand, and that will eventually have some experimental consequences. So we have to understand that. And questions which immediately come to mind, questions like the beginning or end of time. This is why it's so confusing. Questions like initial or final conditions associated with beginning or end of time, the wave function of the universe. It's very confusing. We don't know the answers to them. There were many speculations. And since we have a singularity there, it's clear that GR breaks down. So string theory ought to give us the answer. And how should we address that? Well, curvature, in general, is very complicated. It's hard to address string models when there is curvature. And what people in string theory did in the past was to take a simple model, like an orbifold, where all the singularity is localized at the point or in a certain subspace, and everywhere else, the system is flat. And this was a very useful thing to do because we learned a lot about strings in curved space by analyzing orbifold. So the program here is to take flat Lorentzian space, mod it out by a certain group, a subgroup of Poincaré, and see what happens. And this was a program that was initiated by Gary Horowitz. He wrote a paper several years ago, which I'll give the reference to in few transparencies. And then we can ask what happens. So the immediate investigation kind of takes very little time. You realize that most of these orbifolds are not that interesting. They are not that interesting because the typical orbifold of this kind is closed time-like curves. Even if it doesn't have a singularity, it has closed time-like curves. So the typical orbifold of this kind, you mod out, say, by the simplest orbifold, let's mod out by time goes to time plus a constant. That's the simplest one. It's an orbifold, and it obviously has closed time-like curves. I don't even need to write that on the transparency. So that's not good. It's not good for a whole variety of conceptual as well as technical reasons. In particular, we expect large back reaction. Somewhat borderline is the case of closed null curves, which I'll address later. So here we'll find a very special orbifold, which is not immediately dead. In fact, as far as I know, this is the only Lorentzian orbifold, or maybe I should say the simplest Lorentzian orbifold, which is not immediately dead. And then we'll start investigating it, being very, very conservative, applying the standard rules of string theory. And the game will be as conservative as possible. We'll apply the standard rules and see how far we can push it. Now, various things can go wrong, and it's very likely that it is wrong. But if the model has a problem, we should be able to see the seed of the destruction somewhere in the calculation, and that will teach us something about what this model does. And this model is special in the sense that it does not have all the problems at the same time, and therefore perhaps we can disentangle some of the difficulties that exist. Because usually when you come to discuss any of these models, you immediately have all the problems simultaneously. So the outline of the talk will be as follows. I'll describe the problem, the model. Then I'll just analyze the geometry, just to get familiar with what the geometry is, like the metrics, see where the singularities are. Then I'll discuss functions on the orbifold. I'll denote the orbifold by O. This is basically putting a free scalar field and see what are the eigenfunctions of the Laplacian and so forth, and see what they behave like. This is kind of first quantization. Then I'll quantize strings either in the Lightcon gauge or in covariant formulation, following the rules and see what they do. I'll discuss free amplitudes, torus amplitudes, and analyze and end with some conclusions. Again, it's very subtle, and for the first time we had to address some questions that, as far as I know, had not been analyzed before, like how should we think of amplitudes in string theory in a time-dependent background? What are the observables? What should we calculate? How should we think of them? For example, should we expect analyticity in momentum space or not? And I'll have some comments to say about that later. So some of these lessons could survive even if this particular model is not there, is not right. Namely, well, I'll say very explicitly what can go wrong. So what's the model? So we'll take flat three-dimensional space, R1, 2, and mod it out by a group gamma, which is isomorphic to the integers. I'll denote, lump together the three coordinates x. I'll take two of them and form Lightcon coordinates, 1 over root 2, x0 plus or minus x1, call them x plus minus. This is my convention for the metric, minus 2 dx plus dx minus, plus dx squared. And the group that I'll divide by, the group of the orbifold, is a certain group, subgroup of the Lorentz group, which at first sight looks very peculiar, but I'll present it from many, many different points of view, and gradually you will be familiar with it. So since we'll need it, let me record it here. X plus, x and x minus, go to x plus v, x plus, x minus plus vx, plus a half, v squared, x plus. So this is a Lorentz transformation, where J is this lower triangular matrix. So mathematically, the Lorentz group in three dimensions is spin 1-2, or SL1-2, and it's isomorphic to SL2. SL2 has three kinds of conjugacy classes, elliptic, hyperbolic, and parabolic. The elliptic ones are ordinary rotations. So modding out by that is the same as an ordinary orbifold, which is completely spatial. There's huge literature on that. This is not what we want to do here. The hyperbolic orbifold, if we mod out by that, this is an ordinary boost. This is very, very confusing. So it has closed time-like curves, and it has four asymptotic regions. It's very, very confusing. So let's not do that. The parabolic ones are very special. This is what we'll do here. So this is a parabolic subgroup of Lorentz. Now, in the elliptic one, this is ordinary rotation, we have a parameter telling us by how much we rotate. Here there's also a parameter, v. But all these v's are the same, because by conjugation we can change that. So this is just a property of the Lorentz group. All these v's are conjugate to one another, so we'll find a convenient value, v, we'll set v to be 2 pi. This, again, will end up being a very convenient feature of this model, otherwise we'll run into problems. The reason we picked Lightcone coordinates, how do we go up and down here?
Shift the transparency.
No, no, to focus it.
So underneath.
Underneath.
Just the lenses. Underneath where the light goes.
Ah. Okay, so V is
removable by Lorentz transformation. That's right. What
kind of? Just a boost? Or a boost, yeah.
Boost plus rotation?
I think boost plus. Well, we should be able to see it from here.
Now, of course, you say every V is the same, but V equals zero, of course, is special.
V equals zero is no transformation. It's the identity operator. It's no transformation at all. And the sign of V.
Boost, you can make this thing as close to V equals zero as possible.
That's right.
So what? So in some kind of limit, it's just kind of, what does that mean? I mean, it's just Lorentz.
Well, this is a property of SL2 it's a property of this transformation.
So V means.
I'll soon tell you another interpretation of this. Hold on 1 second, and then you'll have another interpretation of that, which will make it infinitely easier to think about it. Okay? And this is this line. Let's think of X plus as being time. Which would be a very convenient thing to do. We don't have to do that, but it gives us another way of thinking about it. So what does this transformation do? It leaves x plus invariant. That's good. It's x plus doesn't transform. And x goes to x plus v times the time. Well, this is Galilean boost. Mm-hmm. So instead of thinking about it, going relativistic, thinking of SL2 and parabolic and all these fancy stuff, this is nothing but a Galilean boost. So now you can ask your question again. Now it's completely obvious that all values of B are conjugate to one another, because by another Galilean boost, I can change the value of V. And it's also clear that by slowing down, you can get to V equals zero. So J is a Galilean boost, and hence I picked the letter V, because V is the velocity of the Galilean, non-relativistic Galilean boost. I hope this answers your question. It's also a property of 3x3 matrices. So this Oberfold was first introduced in 1990. It was studied in 94 in a recent paper. Okay. In order to study it in more detail, we find it convenient to change variables. And this change of variables is valid as long as x plus is non-zero. So we'll define y coordinates, which I'll record here. Y plus equals x plus. Y will be x over x plus. And y minus is x minus a half x squared over x plus. And these y coordinates have the property that under the Oberfold, y plus and y minus are invariant, and y is identified with y plus 2 pi, because I've already set v to be 2 pi. So here in the y coordinates, the identification is very simple. We just have a constant shift of y. So that's good. And all this complicated transformation becomes an ordinary, y is a circle. And the metric is not too bad. All we have to do is take this change of variables, plug it into the metric, and we get this metric here. What are the killing vectors of this space? Well, originally we had the Poincaré group. It is the subgroup of Poincaré, which commutes with the operation we divided by. We had some generators of Poincaré. What are the generators which commute? Well, it's d by dy, which we also call j, clearly scaling vector of this symmetry. And the other is d by dx minus, which is the same as d by dy minus, which we will call p upper plus. These are the only two Killing vectors. And you can see it from here. We can shift y by a constant, or we can shift y minus by a constant. We do not have a symmetry of shifting y plus by a constant. The identification is trivial in these coordinates. The fact that we have such a Killing vector, this Killing vector, so this Killing vector is spatial everywhere except at x plus equals 0, where this coordinate system is not valid. So this Killing vector is null, and it allows us to pick light cone gauge. So we can pick light cone gauge, so x plus or y plus will be time. The coordinate x plus, which is the same as y plus, plays three different roles. So recall from here that y is like a circle, because y is identified with y plus 2 pi. And the length of the circle, or the radius of the circle, is given by y plus. So a y plus, as y plus varies, the length of the circle varies also. So y plus is the role, is the radius of the cone. So it's the radial direction in the cone. So that we see from this part of the metric. But unlike the usual cones we are familiar with, it's also a null coordinate, we can see from here. We don't have dy plus square, but we have dy plus dy minus. We see it from here. So this is, looks like it, what is usually a spatial coordinate. It's also null, but it will also play the role of time. So it has three different interpretations. All these interpretations, three different interpretations, will be important for us. So let me record the metric here, because we'll, so that if you forget it, you have it in front of you. It's minus 2 dy plus dy minus of y plus square dy square. And the space looks like that. This is the direction of y. This is the direction of y plus. And all this is tensor aligned, y minus. And this is the point y plus equals 0. And this picture is not valid at y plus equals 0. Let me say it again, just in order to review it. So we have our orbifold, which is flat three-dimensional space, modded out by this group gamma. And it's foliated by two-dimensional surfaces, f sub x plus. For every value of x plus, we have a circle parameterized by y, cross a line parameterized by y minus. This circle has radius, which is the absolute value of y plus. All the points with y plus or x plus positive give us a cone minus a tip plus r. This r is this r. It's the line y minus. So this is one cone. And this is another cone cross r. And this is the same picture I had here. These are our two cones, one with y plus or x plus negative, and the other with it positive, cross another line. So this is our orbifold minus the singularity as x plus equals 0. If we include the singular surface, the space is not Hausdorff. It's a very singular space. So before we get into the question of what the metric does there, even the topology there becomes very, very crazy. And now we can finally get, so far this was kind of geometry or topology, and now we can ask questions of physics. If we take this as our background, what do strings do here? Namely, if we let strings propagate here, what do strings do as they reach the singularity? This is a very interesting question we would like to know the answer to. And in particular, can strings propagate from one cone and reach the other cone? And I don't know the answer to that. And I'm not going to take a position on that.
The singularity here is just this null line.
That's right. It's a null, I wouldn't call it a line because it's topologically crazy. But as you approach it, it looks like it wants to be a line. But as you hit the point, at that point, the new directions open up, and beyond that, it still look. The limit at that thought that at that point, the dimension is not what, this is what's known Hausdorff means. It has more points than what it has as you approach the limit. And I can describe that in more detail, but I don't think it's essential for this talk.
Because we go back to the original coordinates.
That's right. In the y-coordinate system, you don't see that. The limit in the y-coordinate system is very misleading as x plus goes to 0. You really must work with the x-coordinate system if you want to describe the overfold. As you can see from here, you divide by x plus. So various things become infinite. So this is kind of a model of a big crunch and a big bang, except that the singularity is null. So let me summarize some of the salient features of this model. First of all, unlike the typical orbifold, where you take Lorentzian space and mod out by a certain subgroup of Poincaré, here there are no closed time-like curves. There are closed null curves. The whole surface, x plus equals 0, has closed null curves. We can see it from the identification. Just look here, set x plus equals 0. So these x pluses are set to 0. X is invariant. And x minus is identified with x minus plus x. It's clearly null. Notice that this is unlike ordinary orbifolds. Ordinary orbifolds are singular where you have a fixed point, where a point is identified with itself. When you have Lorentzian space, you get singularities where a point is identified with a point which is null separated from it. It doesn't have to be a fixed point. And we see it here. Why is this bad? Imagine you compute the expect, you put a scalar field on this background, and you compute the expectation value of the stress tensor. The expectation value of the stress tensor of a scalar field can be infinite. Why will it be infinite? You do some point splitting, and you compute the contractions. In an ordinary orbifold, you get an infinity because a point sees its image when they are at the same point. Here, a point sees its image. They are not at the same point, but they are along the light cone, and you get an infinity. I should add parenthetically, this does not happen for us. The expectation value of the stress tensor in this model is 0 on the orbifold for reasons I'll soon mention. Before the end of this transparency, I'll explain why the expectation value of the stress tensor.
Other fields, other products.
Sorry?
Other objects.
I just won't say the answer. Be a lot more explicit. The other nice feature of this model is that we can describe the evolution from here to here. So we have time dependence, but we have a null direction, a null killing vector. Since we have a null killing vector, we can describe the evolution even before we reach the singularity, and that evolution is first order. So the evolution from one here to here is a parabolic evolution or Schrödinger-like evolution. It's not Klein-Gordon-like evolution. It's a first order evolution. That's even before we get to the complexity of the singularity. So the whole subject, or which is the topic of Burrell and Davis, is not the subject. I don't need to apply for this theory. The reason is the evolution is first order, no particle production. If you wish, I can use light cone gauge. In light cone gauge, there's no particle production. The system can evolve. The system depends on light cone time, but there's no particle production. Okay, so this is one of the standard complication is gone. For large x plus, either in here or here, the system is essentially flat Minkowski space because we have identification over very long, long distance. And therefore, the whole issue of what the vacuum is trivial. So the system has a natural vacuum, is a natural state to work with. It's not an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, because the Hamiltonian depends on time, But there is a natural vacuum, a natural state to start with. This is basically because we have an overfold of flat space, so it inherits a vacuum from flat space. Similarly, the particles are very natural in this system. That's right. And similarly, we have particles because if we have seat here very, very far, we don't care that there's some large identification. And therefore, at least in the far past, or here, we can prepare particles and throw them in. So some observables are very natural in here. It's, of course, very interesting question what happens here. If these particles can get through or not, which will be a question that most of the seminar will be about. But at least in the far past, the evolution, the way we should start from here and move to the right, this part of the evolution is a lot easier than in the generic time-dependent background.
When I think about this as a time-dependent Hamiltonian, it's turning off asymptotically interaction.
Yes.
How fast does it turn off?
The Hamiltonian for particles, the second quantized Hamiltonian is as simple as I just described. It decays as a power. The first quantized Hamiltonian, which should be distinguished from it, in covariant gauge is second order, and there is particle production in the sense of the first quantized theory, and it's very rich. It has a lot of interesting structure. So in the first quantized system, you do populate the high energy oscillator modes, not in the second quantized system. Now, it's not true that as you go far, all the states go to zero energy, because in particular, so it's not true that all the energies go to zero as a power, because you have winding states, which are very stringy, and their energy goes up as you go, because their energy is proportional to the length, and the length goes up. The energy density remains constant. Okay, this is kind of this comment. So at least in here, if we can get through, we can compute an S matrix. What's the amplitude to throw a particle here and to find it out here? Now comes another interesting feature of this model. We have a circle here. I told you how we modded out the Lorentz group, but I kind of was careless in the notation whether the Lorentz group was SO21 or spin21. There's still a Z2 ambiguity, what happens to spinners as I go around. And there are two spin structures as I go around the circle. And the boundary conditions could be such as spinners go to themselves or not. So since we have the option, we might as well take the better one. And there is a possibility of preserving supersymmetry, which is potentially interesting because we know that if we have supersymmetry, it can help us protect the vacuum, lead to some cancellation, and perhaps even help us solve the model, make some exact statements. This is very, very unusual because in time-dependent backgrounds, it's very hard to get supersymmetry. Super Q square is the Hamiltonian. In a time-dependent background, the Hamiltonian is not conserved. So how can we get Q to be conserved? So that's why people usually don't look for Q to be conserved. Just a second. But I've just told you that P upper plus is conserved. So you have half the supersymmetries. Q square is P plus. P upper minus is not conserved. So the Q which squares to P upper minus is not conserved. The Q that squares to P upper plus is conserved. So the Q that squares to the Lightcon Hamiltonian is not conserved. But we have enough supersymmetry, all those Qs which square to P upper plus, to ensure some interesting cancellation. So when I said earlier that the expectation value of the stress tensor does not diverge near the singularity, this is essentially the reason for the question.
I was more comment than probably an unnecessary comment, because I'm sure you know this. This whole business about it being time dependent and being surprised by supersymmetry is, of course, misleading because you have null translational symmetries, and so it's not that time dependent. And in fact, there's general plane waves which have arbitrary amplitudes, right? Arbitrary functional time dependence, which are still supersymmetric because you preserve some.
And this is a close relative of one of them. This is a closed relative of one of them. Well, okay, I'm glad you agree with that, because giving a talk about a subject that I don't know anything about and there are all these experts in the audience is always scary, especially when one of them raises his hands. Okay, I'd like to mention in relation to some other models that people might be more familiar with before we really get into the beef. First of all, a model that is not the same. One can start with an ordinary orbifold, or flat two-dimensional space modded out by Zn, in terms of this modding out of by a subgroup of the Lorentz group. This is modding out by an elliptic subgroup of the Lorentz group. So we mod out by Zn cross time, and then we boost this whole system by n. This limit is not the same as our model. It's not even the same as half of our model, namely one cone. And algebraically, it's clear the limit of an elliptic conjugacy class is not the same as a parabolic conjugacy class. They are awfully close, but they are not the same. It's not even the same as this half. So this is one comment. The second comment is that a very familiar black hole is the BTZ black hole in three dimensions. The preferred one among them is the massless with zero spin black hole. And it has a singularity, which is also its horizon. We can zoom on the singularities, kind of look with a magnifying glass, the region of the singularity. And by doing that, we, of course, flatten out the black hole, the curvature. By doing that, we really get exactly the orbifold that we have here. So the BTZ black hole is obtained as a quotient of ADS, and the quotient goes over to the quotient we do here. The quotient is a subgroup by a subgroup of the ADS isometry, and here it's by flattening it out, it becomes a quotient by a subgroup of Poincaré. Okay, now we finally get to do some work after all this preparation. When we have a space, the first thing we do is solve Laplace equation. We had some killing vectors, so we should diagonalize the killing vectors. So we should find solutions of the following differential equation. An eigenfunction of Laplace equation. We can work in the covering space for that matter. So minus 2 d by d plus, d minus, plus dx squared of psi, psi is some wave function, equals m squared on psi. We also want to diagonalize this funny operator j, this parabolic boost, this Galilean boost. It's another differential operator. It's x plus p minus x p plus on psi equals some number j times psi. And p plus is d by dx minus on psi, is a number p plus acting on psi. And it's relatively easy to solve that. And you either just solve it brute force and you get the following solution, or you use the following trick. In the y-coordinate system, j is d by dy, and therefore the y-dependence is e to the ijy. You just get it from here. The p plus is d by dy minus, and therefore in the y minus direct coordinate, the whole dependence is e to the minus I p plus y minus. You take this and you plug it into the Laplacian in the y-coordinate, it becomes an ODE, which is trivial to solve. This is the solution. This is the solution in the y-coordinate of the ODE. And then you just use this change of variable to express it in terms of x. Once we have this solution, we can ask, what does it do as x goes to 0? And the parameter here, c, is j over p plus. So what does the function do as x plus goes to 0, which is, of course, where all the fun is going to be. All the fun is going to be as x plus goes to 0. And we can't use the y-coordinate system because they are not valid there, so we have to use this expression. No, there's no issue of boundary condition.
You're using a momentum state in the x minus direction. It's actually periodic.
I'm using the boundary condition that p plus is positive, and that's why this equation becomes first order. So there's boundary condition, which is overall scaling of this thing. This is the first order evolution, which is so important. I'll soon tell you how I normalized it. Okay, so now we take x plus to 0, because this is where we expect to see something interesting happen. Maybe the system will break down. So as we take x plus to 0, this factor is very interesting. We get e to the I, x plus goes to 0. So this phase oscillates rapidly. The x plus here goes to 0, makes the whole thing infinite. So the whole thing here is 0 unless x equals c. This is known as a delta function. So the limit as x plus goes to 0 of psi is 1 over 2 pi. This x minus, which we just copied, this thing goes to 0.
How did you normalize? You didn't normalize this to have
that. I'll tell you exactly in a second exactly how we normalized it. This is a correct normalization. Well, not correct. If I normalize it like this, it agrees with that.
Yeah, sure. Why?
I'll soon tell you a preferred normalization that agrees with plane wave normalization in a completely well-defined.
In what sense does this converge to that? I mean, you take the function, if you just sort of fix x and go along taking x plus to 0,
yes,
will oscillate more and more rapidly with bigger and bigger amplitude.
Yes.
It looks like it doesn't have a well-defined.
No, it does. If you multiply this.
So
you integrate it in the test function. If you multiply it with a test function, which does not become more and more oscillatory at the same time
as a distribution,
it converges to that. So this psi, as x plus goes to 0, becomes a delta function. This is very, very peculiar, because we kind of start with something which was an angular momentum eigenstate around this circle. And at x plus goes to 0, it becomes a coordinate eigenstate, which is very, very disturbing. Since it's very disturbing, we should have as many different interpretations of this fact as possible. So first of all, I'll copy it so that we all have it. We have it in front of us. Again, here. And now I'll give many, many different interpretations of this fact from different points of view.
You were before focusing on why it's not coordinate. Here you switch to x.
This is just a change of variables, but the point is that at x plus equals 0, I cannot use y. Away from x plus equals 0, I can use whatever I want. Because away from x plus equals 0, it's a one-to-one transformation. At x plus equals 0, the y coordinate system breaks down. So since I'm interested, I see this is the limit as x plus goes to 0, I have to use x. Okay, how can we understand this delta function in x? Okay, first of all, it follows from the Oberfold identification. In x minus, we wanted it to be a plane wave, because we diagonalize translation along the null direction. So let's look here. X plus is 0. So this, and this is 0. X is well defined in the is not subject to any identification. X minus goes to x minus plus x. We have the x minus dependent. The only way the thing can be well defined under the Oberfold is if what we have here is a delta function with an integer over p plus. So without even solving any differential equation, we see that this peculiar fact that its delta function supported at some x follows just from the Oberfold. Here is another interpretation of the same fact. We had this operator j, which is x plus p minus xp plus, like a Lorentz transformation. At x plus equals 0, this term is absent. We diagonalize p plus, we diagonalize j. Therefore, at x plus equals 0, we also diagonalize x. So the wave function becomes an x eigenstate. The wave function becomes an x eigenstate at the time x plus equals 0, although at generic time, it's not an eigenstate of x. At the time x plus equals 0, it becomes an x eigenstate. It's a very peculiar fact, simply because we diagonalized an operator which depends on time, in x plus time. So we see that at the time x plus equals 0, x is localized on a lattice. The coordinate x is localized on a lattice. Away from x plus equals 0, the wave function is spread out. So I can have a demonstration of this here. Let the screen, so that really remember it, let the screen be the singularity. And here I put something on the singularity. This is the wave function. It's spread out. We get to the singularity.
But Matt, isn't this just happening because the circle is shrinking down?
No, because it's not at the origin of the circle. It's not at the origin of the circle. You see, the origin of the circle is, I don't even know what it is. It's not at x equals 0. It's at some values. This is true for j equals 0. You see, j equals 0 is very special because it corresponds to c equals 0. J equals 0 corresponds to c equals 0. And that's a very special point that y is finite. The other points have some specific values of x. Y is infinite. And y is subject to some identification. You can't describe it in a y coordinate. And you can see that in terms of the wave function, in terms of y. The whole thing cannot be described. So now I can finish the demonstration. Here is the wave function which is spread out. We come in, it becomes focused at x plus equals 0, and now it's spread out again. So the wave function is kind of very, very focused. They're infinitely focused, and then spreads out, and it's not focused at okay, let me put the wave function again. If you put the limit, you see that the limit.
I'm not taking the limit. Before I take the limit, I can tell the expression.
Before you take the limit, you can. Yeah. But then if you try to take the limit, you see that it gives you the delta of j equals 0. The wave functions don't mean anything. Yeah. It makes sense to take the limit only if x at the limit is 0. But it shouldn't surprise you because the whole change of variables is meaningless.
So, I mean, would you agree that it follows just from this observation that any expression quadratic in this scalar field, like a stress tensor, is obviously divergent at the singularity? Because it's like the square root delta function.
If you just substitute this thing in, yes, yes. No, the singularity is a very singular object. And what happens to, say, interacting scalar field there, and even more so to scalar field coupled to gravity, is something we'll have to study. At the moment, I'm just doing kind of the normal mode expansion. We'll then quantize free, take free strings. I'm just following the steps and see where we'll get stuck. Okay. Here is another peculiar fact about these wave functions. Imagine. We started in, after all, this is an orbifold of flat space. So we can start with ordinary plane waves. And here is a way to normalize it in a convenient way. I normalize this to be 1, e to the ipx. This is clearly a convenient normalization. E to the ipx, c plus is a number, p is a number, and p minus is tuned such that the whole thing is on shell. So if I'm looking at this expression, this is an eigenstate of the Laplacian with eigenvalue m squared. Now, if I'm looking at this eigenvalue m squared, this eigenfunction with eigenvalue m squared, I can take different linear combinations of them. There will still be eigenfunctions with eigenvalue m squared. Now, I'll try and do a Fourier transform of that. Now, normally, when we study, when we compute string amplitudes, this will be a vertex operator. E to the ipx. Now, usually we are told that it's not a good idea to do a Fourier transform on the vertex operator because it would not be on shell. But here is a way around it. We'll integrate dp, we'll keep p plus unchanged, but we'll let p minus depend on p. So we'll keep this operator on shell. So this e to the ipx, e to the ip plus x minus minus p minus x plus plus ipx will remain on shell. We'll integrate dp, and we'll let p minus be p squared plus m squared over p plus. That makes some function. And this function is clearly an eigenstate of the Laplacian. And I'll do the Fourier transform, and the Fourier transform will be with respect to P, and the coefficient here will be C. And this function is exactly the function I had before. So the function I had before, which is an eigenfunction of the Laplacian, eigenfunction of J, an eigenfunction of P plus, is exactly this integral. So that gives us another perspective of why the coordinate Xc appears like the parameter Xc appears like a coordinate. The parameter Xc appears like a coordinate because it is obtained by doing a Fourier transform on an ordinary plane wave. So this is like a Fourier transform, and Xc is like a coordinate, and it's focused at this value of Xc when x at the time x plus equals 0. Now that we know what the functions are, we know how to do free field theory, and now we can do free string theory. So I'll start with a Lycon gauge. And I should say from... And we should do now strings in a Lycon gauge, which is useful, even if, well, what I said so far, imagine that when we evolve, say, from here to here, here something rather dramatic happens, and the description in terms of the overfold is wrong. It's quite possible. The evolution for y plus large and negative is still valid. So the canonical quantization of strings in this region is still correct. And I gotta say, it's quite subtle. It's quite subtle because these are strings in time-dependent backgrounds. And for us, it was quite a struggle. And I said that the only way I found in the literature, we found in the literature, where with a formalism that could be used.
You've written down a complete set of solutions.
Here, P plus was positive. There are also interesting functions for P plus equals 0 that I did not describe here, but if you ask me about that, I can tell you what they are. They are extremely interesting and probably relevant. That's probably where all the action is.
What is the Green's function?
We've solved for the Green's function also. It's given a...
What's the bridge?
Well, it does. It does. I'll not be able to reconstruct it right away, but... First of all, it has some interesting singularities in unexpected places. So let me tell you some of the interesting features. As long as one point is here and another point is here, it's kind of almost standard. But every point here, no matter what y minus is, and no matter what y is, and no matter what y plus is in the past, in the, what do you call it, in the past light cone of any point here, which in hindsight is, of course, obvious. But you also see that from the propagator. And also, depending on, well, you could just put this complete set of states and compute the Green's function. And
the set of states with P plus equals 0
for completeness, yeah. But first of all, you can compute the propagator as a function of P plus. Go to momentum space and right, this is a Keeling symmetry. So you can just go to momentum space in one minus, and the various singularities as P plus goes to 0. And the interesting singularity as P plus goes to 0. So in the covering space, if this parameter J is being integrated upon, the propagator is very simple. Just the propagator of free scalar field in flat three-dimensional space, which is a good check on all the formulas.
Right.
If the parameter J is being summed over rather than integrated over, you get a different formula, which is the formula in the overfold. So this is kind of a check that, but all these things have to work. We have not yet addressed the interesting physical question. We're kind of only setting it up.
But you're having
yeah. I don't know whether we put it here. I have it in my office here. Did we write the formula here?
You know.
We wrote these wave functions, and well, you know, once you have the wave function, you multiply psi and psi star and 1 over p plus, integral dp plus. This is what the propagator is.
No. But writing the propagator, something less interesting happened when you have points on both sides.
One here and one there. Right. Yes, that in, and there are interesting singularities depending on x plus and x plus prime. And when this thing is satisfies some condition depending on the j's and the mass of the scalar field. Because you can get some coherence, coherent evolution. Because you can think of this of the propagator as a sum of all classical trajectories, and they add up with the same phase or not with the same phase. So this is one way of thinking about it. The other way of thinking about it, if you do Poisson resummation over j, then you get sum over images. The sum of the images converges or is divergent depending on these subtle phases. This does not lead to new divergences in S-matrix elements, if you anticipate such a problem. But we start very slowly now. Let me quantize. Does not lead, yeah. Because all the singularities occur only at P plus equals zero. Away from P plus equals zero, there is no interest in singularity. Okay, I should have said it this way. At P plus.
There's no particle production, and if you calculate, say, the amplitude of one particle, start out with a one particle state with that, the amplitude is one, if you get a one particle state.
Okay, let's do this calculation. This calculation I can do on 1 foot. Because how do you calculate what's the amplitude for one particle to come in, one particle to go out? That's trivial. I'll just do it in the covering space, and the amplitude is one, it's the same particle. Right? That's trivial. That's because it's an overfold. It's called the inheritance principle, right? That you just do it in the covering space and send in one particle. This is already kind of shocking because the particle, if you follow its evolution, is very dramatic. It goes enormous blue shift, goes through the singularity, and then it goes enormous red shift, but by the time it goes to infinity, it goes back to exactly where it started. So think about it this way. Oh, you don't have time so many time dependent overfolds. Well, they don't have this standard. Well, they don't have time. This lack of particle production. This particular amplitude. But there, they also have an amplitude of starting from the vacuum and get two particles in the future.
No, but I understand that you'd also expect some one particle.
One to one is the same magic.
Yep.
Yep. No, it can. There is an amplitude for one going to seven, but there is also the amplitude for one going to one. Let's quantize strings. So away from the singularity, we can use any of our coordinate systems. And so we can either use the x coordinate system or the y coordinate system. And I can assure you that both of them are subtle, despite appearance. So the subtlety in terms of y, well, the nice thing in terms of y is, how should I put it? First of all, notice that I'm not just using the transverse degrees of freedom. I also include the zero mode. And here, the only formalism that really gets you safely to a sensible answer is the formalism in Joe's book. Every other formalism, different ways you calculate, you get different answers. And I don't know how to make sense of them. So that's the first comment. The second comment is that in Y, the advantage is that the identification is simple, just like a boson in a circle. The penalty you pay is that the Lagrangian has explicit time dependence, which means that the Walsh system is not even Lorentz invariant. not only isn't it conformally invariant, it's not even Lorentz invariant. You lose two-dimensional Lorentz invariance on the world sheet. And in particular, and even worse, at tau equals zero, the y-coordinate system is bad and the Lagrangian is pretty singular. And we know that the y-coordinate system cannot be used there. So these are the good and the bad in the y-coordinate system. In the x-coordinate system, things look pretty easy and standard, but there are a number of subtleties. First of all, the orbit for the identification depends on time. X is identified with x plus tau, which opens up a whole set of confusions. Let me enumerate some of them. X that appears if you're doing canonical quantization is a Heisenberg operator, but if you want to ask what happens to the state, you need to use Schrödinger picture, but you have to impose an identification on operators, which depends on time. So you can imagine that you get into a nightmare, which we fortunately got out of. I don't have time to elaborate on this here. Second subtlety, the Lagrangian, you go from here to here just by using this change of variables that I did not record here, that x here is the same as the y here up to a function, up to a factor of tau. X minus and y minus are related through such a relation. And at the level of the Lagrangian, it's straightforward. One goes to the other. That's not true at the level of the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonians are not related to one another in such a simple fashion. In fact, the Hamiltonian for y is gauge invariant or invariant under the orbifold identification. Not true for the Hamiltonian for x. In terms of calculus, other than this fancy Hamiltonian, x plus was the same as y plus. But d by dx plus, which is the Hamiltonian, is not the same as d by dy plus. X minus, on the contrary, was not the same as y minus. Y d by dx minus is the same as d by dy minus. This was our friend p plus, plus a factor of I. So the Hamiltonian, which is d by dy plus, is not the same as d by dx plus. So the Hamiltonian in the y-coordinate system is not the same as the Hamiltonian here. The Hamiltonian in the y-coordinate system is invariant, is gauge invariant. It's invariant under the orbifold projection. The Hamiltonian in the x-coordinate system is not gauge invariant. Yet you can use it for the evolution if you're very, very careful. So I'm mentioning all this just to show that the road is full of pitfalls and one has to be extremely careful when analyzing time-dependent systems. So I'm kind of taking you right to the bottom line. What happens is the result of the quantization. The easiest way to present the answer is to present the Heisenberg field X as a function of time. And since we are in flat space, in the covering space, the answer is as follows. It has to satisfy the free equation of motion. It has a zero mode, winding states, and standard winding term, and standard oscillators. But it has a few peculiarities. First, the winding mode have a are linear in sigma, as they usually are, but they're also linear in tau. Sorry, but it does. D by d sigma square plus d by d tau square. This is, yeah, this system is pretty smart. Gary invented a good system. And why should it be like that? Because as we move around in the winding states, x is shifted by tau. So this indeed is shifted by an amount proportional to tau. So in the far past, when tau is large, x is shifted by a lot, but near tau equals zero, it's shifted by very little. So w is an integer, and this is a peculiar term. This is our friend xi, which was quantized in units of 1 over p plus. This is where the string is focused. So we see it here. And from here, we get another perspective for this focusing. Recall that p is the same as x, as far as the identification works. P is identified with P plus 2 pi P plus. We can also see it from here. X is identified with X plus tau. So P is identified with P plus P plus. In terms of our Galilean boost, the momentum is identified with the momentum plus the velocity times the mass. We call that P plus is like the mass in light cone. So P is periodic, and if P is periodic, it means that the coordinate conjugate to it must be quantized. So things so far are consistent. Somewhat unusual, but consistent. So the Hamiltonian in terms of X is not gauge invariant, but it's completely standard. The Hamiltonian in terms of Y is gauge invariant, so maybe I should mention one or two things about it. It has some oscillator terms, which are rather complicated. But let me just say a few words about the zero modes. The momentum square, our momentum is J squared, this is the momentum around the circle, is downstairs here P plus over tau square. So this is the term that David asked me about before. What happens as tau goes to infinity? This is the time dependence that disappears. Or conversely, if we send a particle in, it is being blue shifted, and the energy due to this term diverges as the particle comes in. This term can also be interpreted in the standard non-relativistic interpretation of light cone gauge. We have angular momentum square divided by twice the mass times the radius square. This is the moment of inertia. Sorry? Except that radius is time, because the radius depends as a function of time, changes as a function of time. This is the winding mode. So the energy is W squared times the radius square divided by various factors. So in the far, far past, the winding states are very heavy, and they become very light near the singularity. So an interesting question here is, are these physical states or not? And again, we asked some physicists, would you expect in a situation like that the winding states to be physical or not? On one hand, they're clearly here. On the other hand, they are infinitely massive in the far past. Are they described by physical states or not? The answer is yes. In the first argument, you see them in light cone gauge. In view of lack of time, I'll skip the covariant quantization, although it exhibits some interesting. I'll go back to covariant quantization later.
What?
If I have energy, I'll get back to covariant quantization later.
Something about the winding state. So you're saying you see them there, but that doesn't necessarily mean
Well, I'll soon give another very convincing argument, I think, that they are there. You'll see them in the loop.
Right.
You'll see them in the loop in a modular invariant way, how the momentum mode and the winding mode.
Never would see an asymptotic state.
Why not? What? But once you produce them, the geometry will do the rest for you.
The point is that easy to produce when you go through.
Yeah. Imagine the universe. Think of the process just from here. Yeah.
Don't they decay?
W is a conserved charge. So regardless of what happened here, imagine you started the process here. Somehow you got it to start here. Start with an ordinary particle. An ordinary particle comes in, then they are light. You produce two of them, separate them in the other directions. And then let the geometry do the rest. This is a three-point function.
The geometry will create a lot of these winding states near that thing. And then they'll get heavier and heavier and annihilate.
Why should they annihilate? They should either annihilate or can go all the way to infinity.
Well, at infinity, you're going to see an infinite amount of
mass. Infinite amount of mass, not mass density.
Infinite amount of mass.
Yeah. What's wrong with that?
What probably happens is the background will stop the universe from expanding like
or the direction.
No, it's not energy density. It's not energy density.
These things could always annihilate.
Some of them will.
Some of them will. Well, let me show you what we calculated.
If you make something larger, it takes energy density. Usually it becomes a black hole. I don't know what. This isn't energy density.
Yeah, it's not energy density.
It's fixed, yeah, energy fixed density. Density. Yeah. Small, but constant.
Yeah. That's for one string. Imagine you made one of them.
Yeah. But what Raphael's saying is that a fixed small energy density over a large enough volume will indeed form a black hole.
One string doesn't close the universe.
Well, but if the universe is one-dimensional, it will.
No, but you have 23 other dimensions.
Well, you have one other dimension. One dimension. You have one other dimension. So your space is two-dimensional, and your string is wrapping a circle, localized at a point on x plus, x minus.
Okay. And far away it looks like ordinary two-dimensional, but it looks like it's got a back space.
With a very long string going through.
That's going to close flat space, I guess.
Well, it's like having an infinitely long string in a two-dimensional space.
Yeah, which does create a
problem. It's actually worse than a problem. It's like a domain law.
Right.
It's a domain law.
That's a bigger effect.
Well,
this world, you might add other dimensions.
But it's just super special. You don't make these in the ground state. You make them only in processes.
Only in processes, yeah. In the ground state, they run in loops. And in loops, I can show you what they do.
They run in loops, then
in loops, they don't. I wouldn't expect the theory to be worse than the theory without them, because this is a problem that exists. If at all, I would expect the winding states to fix things up rather than to destroy it. So, well, let me show you what we calculated. I don't know, but there are many interesting things to calculate which we have not calculated. An interesting process is one untwisted state comes in.
It might be just an indication that, so you could start out with no, that's a point of minimum zero, start out the first term with your ordinary minus sine squared over, right? That's always there.
Yes.
Except for minimum zero, and except for this one point, which is bad anyway. So any normal state you start with, if you get close to this point, all of its energy turns infinity.
That's right.
And it wants to convert to these winding states.
Not just winding, it could convert to lots of other things.
Convert to lots of other things, but not anything in the first term inside.
Well, I can show you what we calculated. We have not calculated how you produce the amplitude to produce winding states. We have not calculated the amplitude to send one particle in, produce two winding states. This is a very interesting calculation. I don't know what it does. There could be all sorts of interesting subtleties there.
It's interesting for many reasons, as you say, but in particular, in many examples where we know that curvature singularities are resolved in string theory, because they are conical transition, the mechanism whereby this happens is, of course, winding states becoming light.
Yes.
So here, you have winding states becoming light.
Right.
It would be very nice to know if they're somehow responsible for resolving the singularity.
Right.
But you're saying that you haven't done the calculation.
We have not done the calculation because the trick that we have two tricks. We have done three and one loop. David, we have also one loop. We see them in one loop. As I said, I can present to you the calculations we did. I cannot present to you the calculations we did not do. That for the reasons you have just mentioned, I expect the winding modes to improve things rather than to ruin it.
So they improve things in the sense if you know how to change the picture. It only improves.
You can do, there is some kind of t-duality.
I haven't used the t-duality singularity.
No, but there is some kind of t-duality you can use which effectively opens up this dimension.
That's not good enough.
That's not good enough, of course not. For a large number of reasons, but okay.
picture is, it has a curvature singularity.
It's curvature singular. The curvature becomes bad even before you hit the singularity. And the string coupling is infinite. And
what is the integral picture?
Okay, so various people have suggested over the years that if you have one of these pictures of a universe collapsing down to zero volume, the way to deal with it is just t-dualize on the circle, and then the circle seems to go up to infinity, and everyone thinks you've got rid of the singularity. Okay, well, you don't, right? Because what happens is the circle becomes infinitely big in a finite time. Mm-hmm. And so, in fact, that mechanism of going out to infinity in finite time produces a singularity. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in Nani's case, you're dealing with the original space, which has zero curvature, away from this nice line. You t-dualize it, you produce curvature everywhere. In fact, the curvature is getting bad. So in many ways, it's worse than what you start with.
So I could stop here, can describe the three amplitudes and the one loop, and I have some transparencies on outlook. This is my plan. Okay.
Lenny talked
about calculations. The thing about Lenny, he gets them right without doing them. And I get them wrong after doing them.
Yeah. So you said that this is elegant. It's also
I didn't know that.
You take one.